Oyez, 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 the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. Honorable Bruce Castle presiding. All who have business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Thank you. Good morning, I'm Chief Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Hagel, to my left is Judge Davis. We're here today in the matter of William Rickett, has a docket number of 092493. Counsel for the parties, please note your appearance for the record.
Dan Donner for appellant, William Rickett.
Thank you.
Sarah Hartridge on behalf of the Secretary, with me at Counsel's Table is Deputy Assistant General Counsel Gerald Washington.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed? Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 5 minutes, please.
You have 5 minutes, and you may proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Today we are here to discuss whether equitable tolling should be applied in this matter under Bailey and its progeny, since the Henderson decision in the Supreme Court recently decided that equitable tolling is available in this court. In this case, the veteran mailed his notice of appeal to an address.
Let me ask you a question about Henderson.
Yes, ma'am.
Did Henderson actually say that equitable tolling was available in this court?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was do you have Henderson with you?
I do.
What is the last sentence in Henderson?
Your Honor, 7266A is not jurisdictional, and that is what Henderson stands for.
Okay,
the last sentence is whether the case falls within any exception to the rule is a question to be considered on remand. The judgment of the United States Court of Appeals is reversed. So the question of whether equitable...
Doesn't it say in there a sentence toward the end, maybe it's not the last sentence, that we don't decide whether or not equitable tolling applies here or not. They only decide whether or not 120 days is jurisdictional.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not Henderson that...
That's correct. It's this court's decision in both that said...
Fine.
That,
I just want to make sure what you are.
Thank you, Your Honor. The case in both did say that equitable tolling is available in this court. And in this case, Mr. Rickett filed his notice of appeal at an address provided to him on instructions on how to appeal his BVA decision. The address that he sent it to was the OGC. The OGC received it and did not forward it to the court or return it to the veteran.
Counsel, let's talk a little bit about whether or not this document that was submitted is in fact a NOA, a notice of appeal.
Yes, yes, ma'am.
On what basis do you, looking at Rule 3C in Covarris, determine that that is in fact the notice of appeal?
Your Honor, while the rule provides specific information that must be included.
Let's talk about that specific information for a moment. Take a look at 3C and let's go through the elements.
Your Honor, I don't have the rule in front of me.
Yeah, you can take a moment to get it.
Your Honor, I don't have the rule book here.
Okay.
Would you like to have a copy of it?
Sure.
No, You're talking about Rule 3C.
I think we all have it here.
Do we have a copy?
Your Honor, 3C explains the content, which it explains that the notice of appeal should show the name, address, telephone number, and of the person making the appeal, and the appropriate Department of Veterans Appeals file number. And it shall reasonably identify the board decision from which the veteran is appealing.
Right. So let's start with the second element first. Was the board decision reasonably identified? If so, how?
Your Honor, the veteran simply indicated that he was appealing, he wished to appeal his denial to the court.
Okay.
But he did include...
So the answer is no.
The veteran's understanding was that he was supposed to include a number, which was at the top, it said reply to, on the top of the correspondence he received. And he wrote that number. It turns out that that's some sort of an internal routing number, but the veteran understood that to be, it was a 014 number.
What was that number? I mean, in your brief on page 5, you said that that number was a reference provided to the veteran on the cover letter attached to the board's BVA decision. Is
That's
that
right.
correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And it was 014A4, and the veteran wrote regarding RE colon, refer to 014A4. The veteran did not include his claim number, but he did include the number that he understood he was supposed to be referring to in his, based on the information he received from the
Does
board.
Does that number in some way relate to a board final decision?
It does not, Your Honor. The veteran understood that that was the number he was supposed to include. However,
let me just understand what this number is supposed to represent. Again, your brief on page 5 says it was a reference number that was on a cover letter attached to the board's BVA decision.
Correct, Your Honor. The letter that was sent to the veteran, the cover letter to the decision that said, here's your decision, has this number. It says, refer to 014A4.
Right. When, so what does that number represent?
It is an internal routing number for mail at the board, is
okay.
my understanding.
Okay. All right, let's go to the first element. And the language is something along the lines that the appellant should show address, name, whatever else it says. Just read it, right?
Correct. So the veteran provided his name, and his address was included on the envelope and his return address. So okay. that information was provided with his notice.
Okay. So then the language that basically says, I want to appeal to the courts, in your view, is enough to constitute a notice of appeal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The veteran is showing a clear intent to appeal to the court, and...
Did the veteran have any other board decisions?
No other denials pending, no.
Well, did he have any other decisions?
There are no other decisions that... that I'm aware of that we're waiting to be, that were available for appeal at that time period.
So this was the only final board decision
That's
involving
right.
this veteran?
To the best of my knowledge, this is the only BVA decision that was at issue.
Well, don't qualify it.
Oh, yes,
To the best
Honor.
Of your knowledge, is this the only board decision
Honor,
involving this
Yes,
veteran?
Your Honor.
That's what you have to say.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, are you familiar with the Brandenburg against Principi case? At 371 F3rd 1362?
Your Honor, I do not know what the case stands for.
Okay. Well, very briefly, it stands for two propositions, if I can remember them. Due diligence by the veteran and intent to appeal. And my question is whether or not that standard should control these circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor, it should. And the federal court in Bailey adopted the same principles following Irwin, the Supreme Court decision regarding equitable tolling.
Which?
The 1998 decision in Harold Bailey adopted the same principles, which have been followed by this court. And... with regard to a notice of appeal, there is notice and intent. So the veteran, in this case, filed his notice of appeal, and he showed an intent to appeal his BVA decision. The facts of the case show that the VA understood that he had a BVA decision. After the notice of appeal was forwarded by the OGC to the regional office, they handled it as an appeal. They stamped it appeal, and they put it in their file cabinet, which is set aside specifically for BVA decisions.
Could I ask a question here? I'm sorry I didn't ask this earlier when we were talking about it, but haven't we held that the notice of appellate rights is adequate and not confusing?
The court has held that, sir.
Okay. Then why does it make any difference if the notice of appellate rights, first of all, puts the address of the Office of General Counsel on the other page with the idea of appealing, and the heading of it is filing of fee agreements. Now, what would, if we've already said that it's unambiguous, and this, you know, general counsel title is located, as I said, why should we think that it is reasonable for an individual who wants to appeal to the court to send it to the general counsel at the general counsel's address when it is not so indicated in the notice of appellate rights?
First, on a practical level, the address is the same address as the BVA. And while it is provided, and there are three addresses, and while they're provided somewhat separately, it is the same address
of
the BVA.
Okay, well, why doesn't that indicate that he was sending it to the BVA? And then again, the BVA doesn't say that if you want to appeal to the court.
That's
and
correct.
It designates the general, so it's the same address. I mean, he sends it to the general counsel, addresses it to the general counsel.
Okay, well, in this...
I mean, he may have understood it, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that, you know, that he didn't understand it. I think the standard he's here is not particular, in my view, is not particular to an individual, at least, you know, taking aside some elements. But when we are thinking about whether or not we should equitably toll this late filing, don't we have to consider that as one of our factors?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how would you distinguish, why would you say that that falls in favor of the veteran and Mr. Rickett in this case?
Sure. The while the court has found that it's not ambiguous, there are still some elements of it that are confusing and that are arguably not in compliance with 5104.
And what are those elements?
5104, sir. Yeah. 5104 states that in a decision by the secretary regarding benefits to a claimant, the secretary shall, on a timely basis, provide to the claimant notice of the decision, and the notice shall include an explanation of the procedure for obtaining review of the decision. In a case where the secretary denies a benefit, it will also include a statement of the reasons and a summary of the evidence. The case law on the subject, in addition...
So
yes,
none of that applies, I take it.
Well, I wouldn't say that none of it applies, because
he did
receive a notice of appeal,
okay,
from the BVA, and it is the notice of appeal that this court has reviewed.
Correct, but it doesn't say anything about the court in what you just read.
No, not at all.
Okay.
It provides that they must give him an explanation.
Correct.
Of where.
And there's no dispute that they did, at least in my mind.
It tells him that he can appeal to the court, that he has...
What in that paragraph said that he can appeal to the court?
No, the notice that he received, sir.
Okay, not in the paragraph you read.
No, sir.
You were, okay, go ahead,
right.
I'm sorry.
The actual notice that was sent as a result of 5104 to the veteran after his BVA decision was denied. Is the form notice that goes to everybody with the BVA decisions. It has three addresses on it. One is for the court, one is for the BVA, and third is for fee agreements to go to the OGC.
Okay.
Now fee agreements.
Can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
I'm looking at the piece of paper. And the one that talks about the court, it comes first, and it says, how do I appeal to the court? And it says, send your notice of appeal at, and it has an address. I mean, it talks about how do I appeal to the court. Then at the bottom, and then it goes on to say, to ensure full protection of your right to appeal to the court, you must file the notice of appeal with the court, bold letters, not with the board or any other VA office. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think that this issue is why equitable tolling exists. It's why we have equitable tolling.
Okay. Sure.
Even though the notice does have very specific instructions, the veterans do make mistakes and mail them to other offices of the VA, including regional offices, which as recently as in Bove, this court has held would trigger equitable tolling.
Doesn't the law say, and I'm sorry, I would have to think, but consistently says about filing to the regional office that it must, in order to start this thinking about equitable tolling, it has to be filed at the regional office where the claim originated? Not just any regional office.
Well, the cases that have considered equitable tolling dealt with that fact pattern. I would submit that the court is not limited to applying equitable tolling to that fact pattern.
Okay, I'm sorry, I've taken up a lot of your time here. I don't want to preclude my brothers here from asking questions.
Well, you can continue.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, fine. Go ahead. I'm more than willing to pursue this, but I notice you only have 8 minutes left, and I don't want to.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the court has asked us to look at Reed and Edward Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to address those cases because they do deal with a more relatable mm-hmm. set of fact patterns to this case.
Does Reed control?
Pardon me?
Does Reed control? This case?
Reed does not control.
Why not?
Well, Reed was decided in 2003 by this court, and the issue that we're dealing with, equitable tolling, was then also addressed shortly thereafter by the Federal Circuit in Bailey, and now again in both is the most recent.
But Reed involves a misfiling at OGC, right?
It does apply. It does.
It says that, in fact, that was insufficient to equitably toll the time period for filing to this court. So why doesn't that case control these
because
facts?
Because that case is different than our case because the veteran in that case did not exercise due diligence. The veteran did not even file at the wrong location within his 120 days. In that case, the OGC took action.
I'm sorry, I thought OGC was the wrong location.
Yes, it was. And in Reed, he mailed it to the wrong location.
Okay.
But he didn't even mail it to the wrong location within the 120 days.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So he...
Why didn't he? Email it on 12/19 as postmarked by the U.S. Postal Service postmark. And didn't it get caught up in the anthrax situation?
Well,
and therefore it got delivered at a later time?
That is what the veteran argued, but the court did not accept that as a reasonable basis for delay.
It goes to what you're just arguing, that he didn't even mail it in time. He did. He mailed it in time. He mailed it to OGC. It got messed up in the anthrax situation. And the court in December 12, 2003 said, so what? Doesn't matter. Should have filed the RO. So your distinction doesn't hold water.
Well, in this case, the OGC took action when they received the
right, and they forwarded it to the court.
They did. And in our case, they did nothing.
That's not true. They forwarded it to the RO.
They did forward it to the RO.
Right.
But the OGC itself.
But what action they take doesn't matter. I mean, you have an intent of a veteran. The veteran files. We have case law that says he files it with the RO, where it was decided, it's okay. We have case law that says he files it with the board. No discernible distinction, says the Federal Circuit. I'm not paraphrasing, I'm quoting. Right?
Yes.
So we know two offices it can be filed with.
Yes.
We have a case decided December 12th of 2003 where it was sent to OGC. This court said no, not overturned. Correct?
Yes.
So you need to distinguish.
In this case, the OGC forwarded it to the regional office, at which point the regional office also did not.
So is your argument because it got forwarded to the regional office within the 120 days,
it was
therefore in the regional office's hands within that time period?
Yes.
And therefore the case law applies?
It was, absolutely.
Well, that might make sense, except what about the intent of the veteran who sent it to OGC? We can't ascribe intent to the veteran that he sent it to the RO.
He's intending to appeal regardless. So he sent it to the OGC.
All right. So he has the intent to appeal.
Correct.
He sends it to a significant office within VA, the general counsel.
That's right.
Who's the right arm of the secretary, who handles all of his litigation matters.
Right.
And subsequent to this court's decision in Reed came out Bailey, which focused on intent of filing, and then the form or the office to which sent is not sufficient to render the filing ineligible.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as far as filing goes, in this case, all of VA, or certainly the important offices in VA, stamp receipt. And OGC got a stamped receipt within 120 days.
Yes.
So we could. So if that's your argument, that that's a filing, that it's represented by a stamp within an agency, then it meets those two requirements. And this court in Hunt said there are three requirements: due diligence, misfiled document revealing clear intention. There doesn't seem to be any dispute that there's clear intention, at least even accepted by VA in marking it and filing it, as you've noted. The misfiled document put VA on notice. Certainly VA is on notice. So your question comes down to exercise due diligence. And your argument is that anywhere in an important office in VA is due diligence under Bailey.
Yes, Your Honor.
And well, I wish you'd said that.
Well, thank you, Your Honor.
You need to get prepared. You can't come up here and start talking about a case and saying somebody didn't even file in time when they did.
Go ahead. While we're on, now I've forgotten the case. While we're on this case that we're Reed, excuse me. Pardon me. One fact: does the fact that the relative time that the individual held on to the BVA decision before doing anything compared to the time that the VA had it and acted have any relevance?
In Reed, it did. The court compared the two and concluded that the veteran did not exercise due diligence, whereas the OGC took action within a very timely amount of time and forwarded it to the CIBC from after its receipt.
Is that an element that we should consider in this case?
Yes. It is the question of diligence on the part of the veteran. The veteran exercised due diligence by forwarding his notice and showing intent to appeal within the 120 days. It was received. It was then forwarded to the RO within the 120 days and received by the regional office. The regional office did not do anything with it. They didn't do anything that they were supposed to do with it. They didn't. They put it in a cabinet. There's an affidavit in the record that says that's what they did, and that was the end of it. The regional office should have, even if they were confused, they didn't know what it is, If they thought it was ambiguous, they should have either returned it to the veteran with instructions on what he was supposed to do, or sent it to the court, because it did at least say that he wanted to appeal to the court. And that is the difference in the diligence between the appellant in Reed and our appellant, Mr. Rickett, in the instant matter. The case, if the veteran had been notified, as he was supposed to have been, by the regional office that it was received in the wrong place, or if the regional office would afford it, as they should have done, if they weren't going to tell him about it, then he would have had an opportunity to remedy that, because he was still well within the 120 days of his appeal. When the veteran became concerned, only some 3 weeks after the 120-day deadline expired, he contacted the court immediately, and they told him, we don't have it. The same day he sent it to them, he wrote on April 14th, thank you for returning my call today, and I'm now sending you this notice of appeal per your instructions. So the veteran shows at all points that he did have an intent to appeal by filing his notice, and that he was being diligent.
Her time's up, but I'd like to add some for a question I have. But if you have one, would you like me to add some for that too?
I have one other question.
Let's add 5 minutes now. The secretary needs time.
Do you know anything about the physical or mental condition of the individual, or the environmental circumstances in which the individual was operating?
The veteran did have a stroke, and he told the...
Okay, fine. Is that in the record?
It is. It's in his correspondence.
Okay. Is that verified in any way? By a doctor's letter or anything?
No, it's not in the court's record.
Would that have any impact if, in fact, it was verified here?
Yes.
And why is that?
Well, if the veteran's mental disposition, if his ability to deal with this mentally, made it so that he could not respond as somebody who was in a normal health mentally, then the court would apply equitable tolling.
Well,
could.
Excuse me. Good. Okay. All right. That's the only question.
Is the due diligence or the reaction of the secretary on receiving a misfiled notice of appeal an element of consideration in any of the Federal Circuit cases? Or is it, once it's filed with the secretary, that begins the equitable tolling?
In the case, and forgive me for my pronunciation, but it's Jekwe, the court discusses what the VA should do, and according to the manual, the Veterans Affairs Procedure Manual, the court said the policy provides reasonable assurances that even misdirected mail will be forwarded or returned in due course.
Correct. I understand that. My question is, in that case, Jekwe or Bailey or Brandenburg or any of the Federal Circuit cases, certainly in Jekwe, they recognize that the veteran might expect the secretary to forward it pursuant to his M21-1, which he may or may not have to follow. Sorry, that's an inside joke. But did any of the cases make that an element of a decision as to whether or not equitable tolling applied? I thought we just pointed out in Bailey that it was intent, notice to the secretary you wanted to apply, and then the misfiling were the two requirements. And the third, Hunt also talks in general overall about the due diligence. So if the secretary got it and didn't forward it, how does that affect equitable tolling? Once he gets it, doesn't that start the equitable tolling period if we were to apply it?
The federal court has discussed the adversarial.
Which federal court? You mean the Federal Circuit or us?
The Federal Circuit, Your Honor, I misspoke, yes. The Federal Circuit has discussed that while at the regional office, we're still dealing with a non-adversarial relationship, and so the regional office...
Let me ask another way. If they don't forward it, or let's say they got it on the 115th day and forwarded it, and the court got it the 121st day, does equitable tolling apply? Or is the fact that the secretary took reasonable action forwarded it and we still got it late, you don't equitably toll?
The date that... the timing that the veteran is using should control whether equitable tolling is going to be applied. So if the veteran sends it to the timing, not the location, is what should control.
So the date VA receives it.
Correct.
So thank you. That's what I thought I asked.
Because the veteran did file his notice of appeal showing intent to appeal with the court, within his 120 days, the timing of and not the destination should be what the court takes into consideration when deciding whether equitable tolling should apply to this case. And because he did, equitable tolling should apply in this case.
Do you have a closing? Do you say thank you very much? Do you say anything?
Yes, Your Honor. I still had a few seconds left, and I was anticipating that you were going to speak.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you to the court for the time today. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Initially, the Secretary's position is that the January 8, 2009 letter that was received by the Office of General Counsel is not a notice of appeal. The letter was not filed with the court. It was not addressed to the court. It was addressed to the Office of General Counsel. The appellant states he wishes to appeal this to the courts, plural. There is no indication as to what this is. And this statement could not be reasonably construed to be an intent to appeal a board decision to this court. The letter also made no reference to a board decision whatsoever. Appellant's counsel points out that the letter does include a reference number referred to 014A4. That is not the actual correct number that is on the cover letter for a board decision. That letter, that number is 0141A4. Looking at the contents of the letter and the circumstances.
Well, just overall, was the secretary misled? I mean, it sounds like, as I recall the facts, that the general counsel forwarded it to the appropriate regional office, and the regional office understood it to be intent to appeal, and there's only the one board decision. Is that not the facts?
That's not, Your Honor. The notice or the letter that was received by the regional office was associated with the claims file. The original letter, which is in the record, is stamped appeals because there was at the time a board decision that was of record. And under those circumstances, the C file and any mail coming into the regional office associated with that C file is held in an area for 150 days pending a notice of appeal being filed with this court, in which case when the notice of appeal is filed with this court, the C file is transferred to the Office of General Counsel.
So when they got this letter forwarded to the regional office and it got put in this file, what would "I wish to appeal this to the courts" mean? I mean, it was associated with the claim, was it not?
It was, because there was currently a board decision of record. But there was no indication, especially from the employee at the regional office, that it was a letter intending to appeal a board decision to the court. Because the procedure says that.
So where would they be appealing it to when it says, "I wish to appeal this to the courts"?
We don't have any type of reason to know what that would have meant in the person's mind who received it. The only thing that was known is that there is a board decision that is still eligible to be appealed at that time. And the procedure is, if there's a board decision eligible to be appealed, then it needs to be put aside. The C file needs to be set aside, waiting. Whether or not a notice of appeal will be filed with
the court. Well, I guess two different avenues of thought. One, you get this and says, I wish to appeal this, and it's simply a notice to the secretary that he wants to appeal it. And the other is, I wish to appeal it, and I want you to forward it. Are you suggesting that I wish to appeal to the courts, and no one even understood that he wanted to appeal that decision to the courts? Or are you suggesting that we got this, but we didn't know we needed to do anything with it?
I'm suggesting that when the Office of General Counsel received it, there is no indication of what the veteran wanted to appeal to which court, because it did go to Group 2, which does handle matters in the Federal Circuit. There was no indication as to what it was, as far as what was asking to be appealed. So then it was forwarded to the regional office to make a determination as to what it was, what needed to be done with it.
Why wouldn't the general counsel, who presumably is the individual who represents the secretary, knows all about the system, why would the general counsel, would you say that this is an ambiguous document at least?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Why wouldn't the general counsel try to clarify with the individual, for example, by sending it back to the individual and said, look, we got it, can't tell what it is, we're sending it back to you. If you're talking about the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, this is where you send it. Well, don't you think that's a reasonable thing to do?
Your Honor, it may be, but looking at the circumstances, the letter comes in, it comes to Group 2, which again does not handle matters before this court.
But Group 2, if I understand correctly, is the group that either drafts briefs or assists the Department of Justice in drafting briefs, or is a liaison with the Department of Justice in appealing to the Federal Circuit. Now, if I were to compare, I don't know, I would want to compare relative groups, but they are at least, it seems to me, equally qualified, if not more qualified, to recognize the ambiguity of a document and to understand what the Federal Circuit has said about the importance of an individual's rights. So, I'm sorry I'm talking rather than asking a question. But why would the fact it went to Group 2 be any significance in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think in relation to the question of whether or not it would have been viewed as a notice of appeal or ambiguous as to whether or not it was a notice of appeal to this court, then that is relevant. Because under the circumstances, if it had come to Group 7, then
well, who sent it to Group 2?
The veteran did.
So the address on the Notice of Appeal form is to Group 2? Because all I have is VA Office of General Counsel, 810 Vermont Avenue.
The Notice of Appeal of Appellate Rights, page 2, the bottom, is the address which the veteran used, and it's Office of General Counsel, and there are numbers 022D. That is for Group 2.
What was the actual address? I thought it was Office of General Counsel, 810 Vermont Avenue. Did it have that Group 2 on the envelope?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
Oh, okay.
But is that the address that the notice provided?
That's the address that the Notice of Appellate Rights provides for filing a fee agreement.
Okay.
He's talking about the code 022D.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he put that on the envelope, too?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it was taken from the Notice of Appeal? Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I understand this is not something that you have control over, but as I go through this record, I wrote in my notes, common sense, common sense, common sense. Where is it? Big question mark for OGC. Because as Judge Hagel was raising the question, it seems to me that in an ambiguous document, if it's even close to being ambiguous, it would make sense to return the document to the veteran and seek clarification well within the time period to get an appeal to the court. Do you have any idea as to why that didn't happen?
Your Honor, the only thing that I can glean looking at the circumstances of the sending of the correspondence and the body of the letter itself, that the Office of General Counsel did the best thing that they knew to do at the time, which was to send it to the regional office to make a determination as to you know, if there was something pending, what it was, and what needed to happen.
But there had been a final board decision.
Yes.
At the time. So, if I understood your answer to Judge Hagel, the process or the practice is when there's a final board decision and there's correspondence relating to that claim file, that it goes to the regional office and it's held for a period of time pending an appeal to this court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that correct? Okay.
If Your Honors do find that the letter is a notice of appeal, it is our position that equitable tolling would not apply under
the... I'm sorry to keep you on this notice of appeal, but this is probably the time to ask this question. Does the fact that the word courts is plural have any bearing in this at all?
Yes, it is our position that it is, because again, looking at the circumstances of the filing and the body of the letter, it's courts plural. There is no indication that the veteran wanted to appeal a board decision to this court in particular.
Okay, I understand that, but why would the general counsel even think that? Or does the general counsel get correspondence? Do you know if the general counsel gets correspondence about appealing to other courts? I mean, other courts other than here? And, for example, do they confuse the board with the court? Or are there other state or federal courts that you receive correspondence from, or that the general counsel? And if so, if you don't know, that's fine. If so, how do you know?
Again, Your Honor, I can't speak on that specifically because, again, this letter went to Group 2, and Group 2 does handle matters.
I'm just talking about in general.
In general, you're talking about Group 2. Yes,
okay.
In other courts. So, yes, that is definitely possible that there would be no specific indication because Group 7 does deal only in this court, mm-hmm. but Group 2 handles matters in other courts.
But I understand. Okay.
If I'm answering your question, are you asking whether
I guess what I'm saying is I'm trying to decide, it's, you know, what I'm trying to grasp is, you know, whether, because sending it to the regional office may follow VA procedure to a certain degree, but I think as Judge Davis mentioned, you know, I'm trying to get over this common sense aspect of it. In other words, with the idea of looking out for the rights of the veterans. And I think the idea there's an S on here may have some impact on it or may not, but I'm not prepared to make that leap without some sort of substantial representation that the general counsel receives such correspondence to be directed elsewhere than this court, and if so, what that is.
Again, Your Honor, Group 2, which is where this letter was received, does practice litigation before other courts.
I understand.
There are the federal courts for the Federal Circuit, U.S. District Courts, other federal courts, and I would believe, I would you know, be comfortable in saying that they would receive mail in reference to
I understand, but what about veterans? I understand they might deal with those, but they deal with tort claims against the VA, and you know, they deal with probably Freedom of Information Act litigation against the VA. I mean, they're the litigation people. Am I correct about it? Group 2 generally deals with litigation.
Well, Group 7 deals with litigation.
No, I mean
yes.
Other. I'm talking about
yes,
these other courts.
Yes.
So, again, I just am trying to get in my mind, I guess, you know, this sort of dichotomy between the general counsel getting this document that I think clearly says, hey, I want this to go to a court or courts, and understanding this is a veteran, they've had a BVA decision, and in order to file with this court in a timely fashion, it's got to get here. And we have a number of cases that talk about forwarding documents to the court and what the obligation of the VA is and so forth. Maybe not in this circumstance, these set of facts, but we do have certain guidance. So, again, I'm sorry I keep rambling here, but I'm trying to come to grips with this. It seems to me things that we're weighing here, the VA's obligation, whatever it might be, and the fact it's late. So what can you tell me about that that would sway me in favor of the VA?
Excuse me, Your Honor. Looking at the, again, the letter they received by the Office of General Counsel Group 2, we do have several staff groups that practice different matters. Group 2 received it, and if you look in the record, there is an affidavit from the Assistant General Counsel, Richard Hippolyte, who does say that he looked at the correspondence. He was unable to determine what it was. We're not able to say for sure that he could look at it and see that there or know that there was a board decision pending, because it does not address any board decision. It does not contain any reference to a board decision. It does contain the veteran C file number, but again, there's nothing on the face of the letter when it's received to say, okay, there's a board decision, this is the date or this is the
issue. What's the C file number?
The veteran's number that's listed on the letter itself, it's a 55 number, I believe. It's underneath the referred to 014.
Okay, so that was on there?
Yes, Your Honor, that's on it.
So whoever receives this knows there's a claims file?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in the claims file would be all the information?
Yes, Your Honor. The claims file was at the regional office, which is...
Can the secretary stand before us and say that they would be surprised if there was an appeal being filed in that case in this court? Is there any surprise to the secretary that this case was being appealed?
As of right now, no.
How about as of then? How about as of within the 120 days?
Yes, Your Honor. If the letter was received by the Office of General Counsel Group 2, again, the Assistant General Counsel receives the letter, looks at it, does not... know from the face of the letter or the circumstances of its receipt that it is an intent to appeal a board decision, which is why it was sent.
Why is that? Because this Assistant General Counsel doesn't know whether there is a board decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does he have a telephone?
Yes, Your Honor, he does.
Wouldn't it be reasonable? I mean, does he get so many of these that he can't check on it in?
I can't speak on how many of these would be received, but I know that the policy at the time.
What would it take to find out? How difficult is it to find out if this letter is associated with a final decision someplace, and then connect the dots? How hard is that?
Would not be difficult, Your Honor.
I don't think it should be difficult. Mm-hmm. I don't think Mr. Hippolyte should have found it difficult. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's assume for a second to go forward that it put the secretary on notice of an intent to appeal. Just assume that, because otherwise we don't go further, right? If the secretary is on notice of an intent to appeal, then why wouldn't that be a basis for equitable tolling under the Federal Circuit's decisions, Bailey and Brandenburg, and even Jackaway? And even Jackaway.
Okay. Are you asking if equitable tolling would apply? I'm sorry, can you repeat?
Yes. Assuming this is a notice of appeal, mm-hmm. it gives the secretary notice that this person wants to appeal, then why wouldn't that warrant equitable tolling under the Federal Circuit's decisions of Bailey, Brandenburg, even Jackaway, this court's decision in Hunt? What is missing? If we find that it is a clear intention to seek further review, we meet element two of Hunt. It's misfiled, and if we find it has a clear intention, it puts VA on notice, which is element three of Hunt. So why is this not equitable tolling?
Because due diligence is not present.
All right. And so the distinction, I'm just going to try and cut this down, but the distinction it seems to me that you're trying to make is, if you file with the RO, which isn't mentioned on the notice of appeal, or you file with the board, which you're not supposed to file with, and you make a mistake in filing with one of those two, you nevertheless meet due diligence because you have filed according to the Federal Circuit. And so the question is, what makes the General Counsel's office different with regard to the due diligence? And haven't they really established, even though those cases involve specifically the regional office and the board, that the due diligence is really the filing And I think we already noted, and the record reflects, that the general counsel does stamp these when it comes in. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why is it different?
It's different for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. This court in Bobbitt has found that due diligence does not extend to papers that are filed at the Office of General Counsel. Looking at the case law that you just spoke of, these NOAs at that time were filed, as Judge Hagel said, with the regional office at which the claim originated, or with the board where the veteran had some familiarity, he had had some contact with those parts of the agency. In this case, filing with OGC is different. The veteran had not had any prior contact with the Office of General Counsel. And we're also looking, even in the difference between the adversarial and the non-adversarial proceedings, once you are filing a claim, or excuse me, filing a notice of appeal with the court, you've moved now into the adversarial.
Well, let me ask it this way. If the veteran had sent it to the secretary himself, "Dear Mr. Secretary, I wish to appeal this to the court," and let's say it goes further, so we can, accepting it as a notice of appeal, okay, so we don't have to argue about that. I gather your position would be that since it wasn't sent to the RO or to the board, it wouldn't be due diligence, even though the secretary is the entity that is on top of all of this.
Yes, Your Honor.
And again, why would that be? What's missing? I mean, what would be the reason not to? I'm just trying to figure that
because
out.
Because the secretary is not the court. Your intent, your due
diligence. Well, the secretary is not the court, but he's also, I mean, is he not the RO?
Yes, the Veterans Affairs includes the RO, the
okay,
board.
Okay, so why wouldn't it be the same as sending it to the RO or the board?
Because, again, the veteran.
I mean, when I write these decisions all the time, I say the RO. Sometimes I just throw the secretary because he's the whole
shebang.
Thank you. So why would it not be the alter ego? Why would it not be the same? And then again, just to carry it on, why isn't the general counsel the alter ego of the secretary?
Again, Your Honor, looking at the adversarial proceeding at this point, you are, what I believe, saying that the veteran should be able to file a notice of appeal to this court with the opposing party. And the notice of appellate rights, which the court has found and the Federal Circuit has found, is sufficient, is not confusing, puts the veteran on notice that the notice of appeal must be sent to the court. It gives the court's address in a clear, concise basis. It's indented, it's bold, it's centered in the bottom of the page. It tells the veteran where the NOA should be sent. And so under those circumstances where the veteran has been provided notice of how to afford himself of his appellate rights, he's been given the information. Yes, there are situations where there have been exceptions made where a notice of appeal has gotten to the RO based on the veteran filing with the RO.
So you just to summarize this, you would take Bailey and narrow it on its facts to it being filed at the regional office from which the veteran's claim originated, and the subsequent Federal Circuit case that said we don't see much difference between that and the general counsel, and say box it there.
Yes.
And not take the broader view that it's notice to the secretary that the appeal is being filed and some type of filing may be documented by the stamp on the thing. And that's done enough.
Yes, Your Honor, because it's not received by the court. It would be received by the secretary under those circumstances.
I have another question. The appellant's counsel indicated in response to a question that I asked her that Mr. Rickett had suffered a stroke. Assuming we took that as a fact, would the secretary believe that would have any impact on our decision to apply equitable tolling?
If the veteran in this case had had a stroke and had information or corroborating medical evidence that medical issue or the residuals of that stroke prevented him from being able to timely file his NOA, then I believe that would be something that this court could consider as far as whether or not equitable tolling would apply.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel,
Are you familiar with Brandenburg?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's take a look at, I can't tell the page, it looks like around page 5 or 6 on paragraph number. The paragraph begins with admittedly, these scenarios all involve timely misfilings with the regional office rather than with the Board of Veterans Appeals, or we could say, or General Counsel's office. But whether equitable tolling applied in each case did not hinge on that particularity. Instead, the focus was whether the veteran exercised due diligence in preserving legal rights and whether the veteran's intention is clear and the VA has put on notice of his intention to seek further review of his claim. And really, I guess this is about the similar questions as both Judge Hagel and Judge Castle just raised. The due diligence, you know, if you follow and apply the Brandenburg analysis, and assuming that there is a notice of appeal, for the sake of argument, don't we get to a due diligence conclusion?
It's our argument that you don't under these circumstances, Your Honor.
Because the notice was filed with OGC?
Yes, Your Honor.
As distinguished from the RO or the board?
Yes, Your Honor. And additionally, looking at Irwin, the Supreme Court has found that looking at the principles of equitable tolling, they do not apply when there is an issue of garden variety excusable neglect. And under these circumstances, that is our position, that the veteran, he admits that in his haste, he found the wrong address, which is on the second page of the Notice of Appellate Rights. He does say that he had poor eyesight, but again, he was able to read the Notice of Appellate Rights in order to reach the address at the last page. He also, if you look at the Notice of Appellate Rights, underneath the court's address on the second paragraph down, or excuse me, the first paragraph after that, it says that you can get information about the Notice of Appeal, the procedure for filing a Notice of Appeal, and other information, and other matters covered by the court's rules directly from the court. It gives the court's web address and the court's fax number. Right. And the veteran did call the court once, I think counsel said it was 3 weeks after the 120-day deadline had passed, to find out the status of his appeal. So under these circumstances where the veteran is, he's able to read, he's able to write, we do have several pieces of correspondence from him, he was able to understand the information on the Notice of Appellate Rights, he simply picked the wrong address. And while the Secretary does sympathize with the veteran, looking at the case law that we have, equitable tolling would not apply under these circumstances. And if there are no further questions, we would ask that the appeal be dismissed.
Before you go, I want to reiterate something that I said, and I think these notices can be viewed two ways. One is the veteran wants to appeal, and does that initiate equitable tolling? And the second is, should the Secretary take some action? And I don't think there's any ill intent ascribed to the Secretary in taking this at the General Counsel and forwarding it to the RO and not forwarding it to the court. I think it's just a question of whether or not the requirements as established by the Federal Circuit for equitable tolling to apply. Having said that, it doesn't mean that generally when the Secretary gets something, we're all dealing with veterans. And you see the case law coming from the Federal Circuit, even when it was jurisdictional. Now it's an important rule. We adopted basically the same things. That, I think as Judge Hagel was alluding to, why isn't something taken if it comes from a veteran, a claim file is notified, to go ahead and take the action and send it back? A separate issue, if you will, at least in my opinion, than the equitable tolling issue. And I just throw that out. I mean, you have enough of them. I forget the number that we counted during the time period after the initial Henderson case here that were rejected, that had been filed below. So it's happening. and it's a recognition. Sometimes the best notice you give isn't going to keep veterans from making mistakes. And we all went to law school, and one of the things we learned in law school was get it to court on time. Well, they don't teach you that because it's something that you get in your head naturally. Anyway, I just throw that out as my own two cents, not necessarily.
Well, let me add to that. I would hope that from an administrative standpoint, something has changed, is changing, or will change as a result of issues like this.
Thank you, Roberts.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd only like to touch on a couple of quick points. In response to the Secretary's statement that the OGC was unable to determine what this notice of appeal was, the Secretary is conceding that it was at least ambiguous. That being said, there is existing case law on point as to what the Secretary is supposed to do in those circumstances. The case was cited in the appellant's brief at page 8 and 9, and it's Boone versus Shinseki. And the Secretary should have promptly returned the notice of appeal to the appellant as misfiled, accompanied by an appropriate explanation of the appellate rights form, or sent it to the court. One or the other. The court has already said what is supposed to happen under those circumstances, and this case fits squarely into the fact pattern there. The court said if it's ambiguous, if you don't know what it is, if it's ambiguous, you do two things. One or the other. One, send it to the veteran with an explanation of what he's supposed to do correctly, or send it to the court. Neither of those things happened, neither at the OGC or at the regional office. As a result, the veteran's 120-day time period passed. Had they done what they were supposed to do during the 120 days, the veteran would have definitely been able to cure that. His diligence was very reasonable in that he, at all times, was within the 120 days of his time period. He showed intent to appeal to the court. The fact that it says courts.
I'm not sure diligence was very reasonable, but I suppose it might have been legally reasonable.
Well, he did do it with at least within the 120-day time period, Your Honor. And the fact that it says courts maybe makes it ambiguous, but it's a layperson writing this, and the lawyer at the OGC should have been able to discern what based on the information provided. Additionally, The fact that some of the information was not included should not foreclose the veteran's notice of appeal from being treated as diligently filed, and it shouldn't preclude the court from applying equitable tolling. The court in Jackway specifically stated that the inadvertent failure to meet each of the requirements should not foreclose the veteran's appeal and should not prevent this court from being able to apply equitable tolling. And with that, Your Honor, I would request that the court please allow this case to go forward under equitable tolling. It meets the elements. It was timely filed, though to the wrong location. The court says timing that location should be controlling, and the veteran's diligence is shown in the record.
Thank you very much. The case will be submitted and will come down and recounsel.
All right.